Thank you so much, band. I was really digging that last tune. Some good good vibes, good chords. Oh, and just perfect timing. The sun coming through the windows on this beautiful fall day. I don't know if you were listening to the scripture passage today, but there's some challenges in there. And it's a heavy passage. And so Erin Glanville, our lead pastor, I think she did a pro move in what you would do on any passage talking about sin and death is get a guest preacher. And so we've done just exactly that. And joking aside, the reason for that is Erin and myself and Nelson, we're up at a leader retreat and 30 other leaders within our church community. And they're still up at Stillwood Conference Center up by Cultus Lake. So if you think of it, say a prayer for the leaders this morning as they gather. And again, just for refreshment and training and connection. And yeah, so we're not trying to offload a tough passage, but we are. And another reason is, Jonathan, why don't you join me up here? This is Jonathan Lips. Yes. If you've been around Artisan, you've received from his musical treats. And this morning we get to receive from some theological treats. Jonathan was asked specifically to talk about Genesis because he's had some academic interactions and study with the book of Genesis. And so I don't know if you're going to say more of that, but I just want to welcome you into this moment. And I said it to everyone else, and I'll say it to you. I hope that you feel free to be yourself in this moment and give what you've, to offer what you've prepared. And we bless you and receive you. Brother, thanks.
Thanks, God. Yeah, I'll definitely be myself. One of the core features of myself is that I'm a huge nerd, so we're all going to get to experience that this morning. And yeah, we are talking about sin. Yikes. When Erin asked if I would preach this morning, and I learned that the topic is sin, I thought, you know, why you gotta throw me under the bus like that, Erin, first time speaking in front of this community on such an unpleasant topic, unpleasant word. And, you know, obviously many of us will have complex histories with that word and the concepts that might be associated with it for us. And not only talking about sin, but sin in Genesis, like original sin, kind of a double yikes. So my goal this morning, though, is to talk about sin by leaning into some of our, you know, current core themes at Artisan that we've been talking about as kind of an MO for everything that we're doing, specifically healing and imagination. Healing because of that, you know, complex or troubled history that some of us might have with that word sin. I want to ask whether it's possible to understand that word in such a way that it brings us closer to God and each other and further away from shame and judgment. And then imagination, because I want us to feel free to reimagine Genesis and what it actually says about sin, while hopefully staying, you know, in a faithful relationship to the text. So as a bit of an intro, I think it's very interesting to look at the wider ancient Near Eastern culture that the Israelites who wrote Genesis found themselves in, and some of the basic contrasts of that culture with what we find in Genesis. I think this will help Genesis's radical perspective to really pop out that we sometimes miss by kind of reading it through a modern lens. And by the way, if you're just coming into the series this morning, the phrase ancient Near Eastern is one we've been using a fair bit the past weeks. And it basically refers to the set of cultures that existed around the Israelites in ancient times. People like the Babylonians, Assyrians, or Egyptians, maybe you've probably heard of. So one thing that's common about all of the ancient Near Eastern creation stories was that violence was built into creation itself. So, for example, we have the Babylonian creation myth, which was called the Enuma Elish. And this is something that would have been very familiar to the Israelites. It would have been like one of the big stories that was out there in the world that everybody knew. And in this story, the heavens and the earth are created not out of nothing, but from the kind of slain body of this mythical water serpent named Tiamat, after being killed by the god Marduk. So violence was a core part of the created order. It was how the world came to be in the first place, was through this act of violence. And so in the, you know, those cultures, the only really inappropriate violence that existed was violence that reversed or went against the established hierarchy. So, you know, the hierarchy for those cultures was gods were at the top, and then, you know, kings, you know, priests, men, women, slaves, children, animals. I mean, it may not be that exact order, but that was kind of the basic gist, right? There was a static order of a hierarchical value. And so in these societies, you know, sin or doing wrong was about stepping outside of that order. Doing right would have been kind of knowing your place in that order, upholding that order, making sure that, you know, you didn't get outside of it, fulfilling your responsibilities and duties that went with your place in that order. But in Genesis, creation happened out of love and not violence. God just spoke. There was no fighting. God just spoke and called creation into being in all of its lovely, you know, differentiatedness with a loving word, not with violence and domination. The origin of violence in Genesis is from humans, really. They bring violence into the picture against God's desires. And in Genesis, all humans are seen to bear God's image, be image bearers of God, equally, right? Men, women, children, there's no distinction that's made in any kind of hierarchy there. And so in Genesis, all life is sacred to God, not just the life of kings. And so we see that in Genesis, domination, violence is not part of how the universe was fundamentally created or is fundamentally supposed to work. And this is, I think, an extremely provocative message in that time, in that context. And I think what it says about sin is that sin is actually treating other people or other parts of creation in a way that's not reflective of God's loving care. So that's why when Cain asks God, you know, in the passage we read, am I my brother's keeper? The biblical answer, based on everything that Genesis set up to that point, is totally obvious to anyone who's been listening. The answer is yes, Cain is his brother's keeper. In fact, we're all meant to be each other's keepers. That's the whole idea. Okay, now let's dive into a little exploration of what sin is, what it means, how it works in the early chapters of Genesis. I want to talk about kind of two main aspects or features or points here of sin, though obviously we could talk about a lot more. First main point, sin in Genesis and the Bible in general doesn't specifically mean something like moral badness or immorality or evil. It can include actions that fall under those categories as well, but sin itself as a word has a much broader meaning that we'll look at. Secondly, the sin that we refer to with, you know, the phrase the fall, right? This story of Adam and Eve eating the fruit doesn't really fundamentally change reality in some cataclysmic way, the way we sometimes think about it. So I think when we realize these things about sin, about the way Genesis talks about sin, the upshot is that what God cares about, and so I think what maybe we should care about, is the protection of life and wholeness that, you know, in this kind of sermon series and previously at Artisan, we've been calling shalom, this kind of umbrella word for life and wholeness and goodness that God wants in the world. And shalom is very distinct from something like moral perfection or, you know, performing well morally. And those are things, obviously, that we can be consumed by, trying to be perfect according to some standard. And this can obviously lead to shame or condemnation, self-condemnation or judging others. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So let's dive into kind of the first main point here. This is the point, again, that sin in the Bible can be regarded as, you know, what we might sort of flippantly call oopses with consequences instead of just, you know, moral badness or evil. I'm being, you know, obviously, like I said, flippant there with that word oopses. Many things that go wrong in the world deserve a stronger term than oops, but you'll see what I mean. So what does the word sin mean in the Bible, kind of going back to some of the, you know, original languages that the Bible was written in? So in the Old Testament, so Genesis, what we're looking at today, the Hebrew word for sin is chata, which actually has a kind of boring or like very practical definition. It just means to miss the mark, to not hit something that you are aiming at. Like if you're, I don't know anything about basketball, but I know there's these things called like free throws. Or is that soccer? I don't know. Anyway, it's where you're like, you know, you're trying to get the basket into the goal or the hoop or whatever it's called, and you miss, right? That's a sin, basically, in the way that the Bible, you know, uses the word sin. And even in the New Testament, the Greek word that's used to mean sin is just a translation of the Hebrew word. It has the same meaning, hamartano, but it also just means to miss something, to err in what you're trying to do. So in the Bible, both Old and New Testaments, the word has kind of a more morally neutral meaning than we often assume. It can cover, you know, very small, insignificant misses, like, you know, missing a free throw in basketball, or more significant, you know, misses or errors, all the way to what we would recognize as, you know, really, truly, massively harmful, evil actions. But in and of itself, the word is just describing that act of missing, of not hitting the target. So, you know, according to scripture, you could sin just by not achieving what you set out to achieve, however mundane that might be. But again, this doesn't have anything to do with morality in and of itself, like whether an action is morally good or morally bad, just whether it hit the target. You know, you wouldn't call your favorite basketball player. Some of you probably have basketball players that you know. I don't, but you know, there are these people who are basketball players, and if you like them, and they're making free throws, and then they miss a free throw, you wouldn't, you know, shame them for being morally bad for having missed that throw, right? Or, you know, maybe some of you would, but probably care a little too much about basketball. In that case, the idea is that, like, we can differentiate between a mistake and something that's like morally bad, generally, and kind of depends on circumstances and things like that. So sin is always relative to a target, but what is the target? In other words, what kind of missing the target, i.e. sin, does God actually care about? Because I don't think, you know, contrary to what some of you think, I don't think God really cares about free throws. You know, maybe there are exceptional cases. Anyway, so in Genesis, the target seems pretty clear. Humans are told they're supposed to cultivate the world with the love and care of God while reflecting the harmony of God in human relationships. Again, this is what we've been referring to as shalom. But different cultures at different times have defined their target as many other things, right? We talked about the ancient Near Eastern target a minute ago, the target of upholding the static created hierarchy. So maybe one question to kind of think about while you're, you know, zoning out for the rest of the sermon is like, what are the targets that your culture or cultures care about? Whether you consider yourself to belong to a Christian culture or culture from your national heritage or, you know, just kind of modern West Coast Vancouver culture, whatever that is. As we go on with the sermon, I think it's interesting to ask yourself, how related or unrelated are the targets, those cultural targets, to the target of shalom that God describes in Genesis? So to recap this point, the biblical word for sin can cover all kinds of failures, from minor oopses to major failures that we might all recognize also as evil or morally bad. And just to be clear, there is serious harm, hurt, and even evil in the world on both systemic and personal levels. So I'm not trying to imply that that's not the case. And as we'll see a few chapters down the road in Genesis with the story of the flood, God takes the problem of human evil very seriously, precisely because the consequences for his beloved creation, humans included, but extending beyond that, these consequences are so devastating. So the point that I'm trying to make is just that kind of this is all a big spectrum of what the Bible refers to as sin, from minor mistakes to, dramatic evils. Personally, when I think about sin this way, it's already a bit healing for me compared to, you know, what I happened to grow up with in terms of my understanding of sin. Since if we can disentangle our, you know, sin from always being strongly linked to some kind of moral badness in ourselves, I think we can consider our actions, consider what we've done a little more neutrally, a little more honestly, without necessarily adding shame and self-condemnation into the mix that comes with feeling morally bad, right? And maybe it would also help keep us from judging others in this morally good or bad way, which can often be problematic. Because, as we all know, I think shame and condemnation, whether self-directed or other-directed, only heap additional unnecessary consequences on top of what's already happened. So to put this question, you know, specifically to each of us, are you or am I currently wrestling with, you know, any consequences of missing the mark in some way right now, whether that's kind of large or small? Got a couple things in mind for myself. Does putting those consequences in light of God's fundamental target of shalom help you maybe recontextualize them in a way that reduces shame? Are some of the ways that you felt, you know, sinful in the past perhaps related to missing a culturally defined target rather than God's target of shalom? And could you let those go? Or, you know, on the other side of it, are there ways that you've been hitting culturally defined targets that have nothing to do with God's target of shalom? And, you know, is it worth examining those and seeing how worthwhile they are, however much they're praised by our cultures? And finally, can you trust that even when you do miss a target of some kind, that God has no desire to shame or condemn you, and that he has a much greater desire to heal you and restore you and to do good things in the world to help limit the harm that's resulted from your or someone else's actions. Okay, let's look at this point in connection now with the early chapters of Genesis and unpack a little more this understanding of sin, conceived of as missing the target of shalom. Interestingly, you might have noticed this when you read Genesis, the word sin doesn't show up until the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis 4, although, you know, we usually think of sin as having already happened by that point. It is clear that God had set some specific targets for humans, in addition to like the general target of being fruitful and multiplying and caring for the earth and so on. God asked the humans not to eat from this one specific tree. We'll talk about some possible reasons for that prohibition a bit later on. But regardless, the humans knew this was something they had been asked not to do, right? Eve clearly knew it when she replied to the serpent in the passage we read. Although, you know, you might have noticed that she added more to the prohibition when she was describing it back to the snake than was actually there to begin with. She said that humans, you know, weren't even allowed to touch the tree, which of course painted the prohibition and therefore God in a little bit of a stricter, harsher light than was actually the case. Let's like camp on this thought for a moment. Why don't we ever talk about this little comment of Eve's as maybe the first sin? Because Eve is apparently not being super truthful or accurate about what God had said here. I think this, you know, to me this says there's a sign here that we can often focus too exclusively on the act of eating the fruit and not the wider story of how humans got to that point, how they reconceptualized their relationship to a good creator as something a little more limiting, a little more harsh than was actually the case. Another way of putting it, isn't it the case that a moment of missing the mark in a huge way, like a big sin or a big error, often takes place in a context where many small, you know, shifts of perspective have already taken place? I think sometimes it's these little, almost unnoticeable bits of how we come to see God or others that end up blinding us to the fact that we're about to miss the mark in a huge way later on. Many people have written about this, obviously. For example, like people who analyze how atrocities like genocide happen, where you have these groups of, you know, normal, seemingly good people that eventually allow or even commit these awful things in the world that baffle us. So these massive ruptures of shalom don't happen instantly in a vacuum. And I think Genesis is kind of asking us, without explicitly saying it, to really pay attention to the shift of perspective of God here in the lead up to actually eating the fruit. As an aside, I think this is also what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 5. You might remember he says some things like, you know, paraphrasing, you know, being angry with somebody is like murdering them, or lusting after someone is like committing adultery with them. I don't think Jesus is actually saying that being angry and murder are equivalent actions, right? And that we somehow deserve the penalty for murder just because we're angry. I think if we take that kind of perspective on board, it leads to a very, you know, shameful and punitively oriented relationship with God. I think the point Jesus is making there is that even anger is a rupture of shalom. And if we're not careful in our hearts, that rupture of shalom that's just, you know, within us will widen and deepen and come to have serious consequences out of the world, as depicted by my emoji thing, which didn't come across very clearly. Those black lines are supposed to be pictures of people's heads. So you've got someone's head with lots of little, anger bubbles happening, and then eventually it kind of bursts out and goes to that person. I don't know why it looks like that. Forgive me, gathering, for I have sinned in my my slide-making skills, apparently. It's like God said to Cain when his jealousy and anger were brewing into murder. It's the same point, right? Missing the mark of shalom in a serious way, i.e. sin, is crouching at your door. And so if we want to keep from contributing to a major rupture of shalom, like murder or something awful like that, we do need to be vigilant about what's happening in our hearts. So had to bring Jesus into the conversation somewhere. So that was that. But back to the main plot line in Genesis. Interestingly, nowhere after the humans eat the fruit does God declare them morally bad or sinful. In fact, when their deeds do come to light, he simply describes consequences. These consequences are called curses in Genesis 3, and that word has this, you know, kind of magical, punitive connotation to us in our culture, and it's easy to read them as punishments. But except for maybe what happens to the snake, the curses aren't actually framed as simple punishments. I would argue instead that they're framed as natural consequences of the human's actions. To understand this more clearly, I think we have to have some idea of what the tree of knowledge of good and evil was. Unfortunately, the Bible doesn't really tell us super clearly all the details we might want to know about it in the story. All we know is that the fruit, you know, opened the human's eyes, whatever that means, caused them to realize they were naked, and made them like God, knowing good and evil. So we don't know too much about kind of the metaphysical nature of the fruit, right? What were its chemical compounds that led to these crazy things? Also, I don't think Genesis is encouraging us to think about it that way. What's interesting, though, is we do know something about how the fruit was eaten. Regardless of the potential benefits the humans saw, it was eaten in contravention of a loving God's warning. And so contravening that warning reflected either a distrust of God, or maybe a disbelief in God, or maybe giving in to just an overpowering desire for what the fruit offered. So are these, you know, curses punishments for eating the fruit, or are they something more? I think it's a better reading to see them as natural consequences for ignoring the loving limits set by a loving creator. So let's unpack those consequences a little bit more. To the woman, God says in the NIV translation, which is up there now, I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor, you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Pretty nasty stuff. The second part of it about the husband and all that, I think is kind of easy to see as a consequence of the breaking of trust that had already happened. You know, remember this blame game that the people engaged in when God said, where are you and what have you done? And Adam says it was her and so on. So there's this rupture of human unity that's already happened. So instead of, you know, this mutual delighted harmony where, you know, earlier we had Adam saying, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Now there's this rupture. There's this prophesied battle for dominance among humankind. And in fact, the word desire here is not actually a good translation of the word. Like, it's not a positive thing. It's better translated as maybe control or consume in kind of a negative way. It's the same Hebrew word that's used in the passage about sin desiring to have Cain later on. So this is not like a good, positive kind of desire. This is like a, you know, consuming sort of desire. The first part of that curse, though, about childbearing does sound a little bit more like a punishment, I would say, where, you know, at least the way we have it written up here, It sounds like God is taking this childbirth experience, which, you know, we might have imagined would be painless or less painful in Eden or something like that, taking this experience for women and kind of cruelly making it worse for them. And how does that make sense? How do we square that with a God that's not kind of conceived of as punitive? Part of it, I think, is that the verse is actually translated quite poorly in the NIV, at least. A more accurate translation would be, "I will greatly increase your pain and your conception. In painful circumstances, you will give birth to children." Interestingly, it depicts God as increasing Eve's conception. It's not increasing the pain in her conception, it's increasing Eve's conception, and then also pain. But it's like these are two things which are kind of going up at the same time. It's not that conception is becoming more painful, so you have more pain and more conception. How or why is God doing this? It's not totally clear, but certainly one of the consequences of eating the fruit is that the humans, you know, no longer are able to dwell happily in Eden. We'll talk about the expulsion in a minute, but it's clear that this expulsion from Eden is something God is forced to do out of necessity. That's how it's framed in Genesis. So is it that in the kind of new mode of human rivalry with one another after the fall, that conception of children somehow becomes a tool or consequence of that rivalry, going hand in hand with the attempts to consume and the attempts to dominate? You could imagine, this is just speculation here, but go with me for a moment. You could imagine or maybe point to a society in history where women being, you know, tied up with pregnancy and childbearing is something that's used by men to delegitimize women's contribution to society or prevent them from having authority or contribution in other ways. I don't know, has that ever happened maybe? And as for the man, the consequences seem to involve something like greater difficulty or pain in working out the vocation to cultivate the earth. And again, these seem to be natural consequences of not being in Eden anymore, of being outside of Eden, because outside of Eden is not this idyllic garden, but rather the real world that we all now know and live in. And it appears that this outside of Eden was already that way, even when God declared all of creation good, right? Creation was good before God made a garden in Eden. So whatever was outside of Eden was already good, was already the way it was supposed to be. And so we don't have this vision of like a bad or hellish landscape, some kind of punishment that the humans are being driven into. It's just the reality that outside of this special garden or sandbox that God had made in Eden, fruit doesn't just grow automatically without putting any kind of work into it, right? And that's now where Adam and Eve have to be, in this place that involves work and struggle, which is new for them. And so finally, we have the humans being expelled from the garden. And here we get a real explicit explanation in the text that says the expulsion is a necessary consequence of how the fruit changed humankind. So it's clear that whatever it did to Adam and Eve, you know, that making them like God, whatever that means, it made it not safe for them or for the world to simultaneously have access to the kind of unlimited life that the tree of life provided. So it can be, again, tempting to see God as, you know, enacting a punishment here. But we have to remember, this is the same God that made the tree of life for them and wants their good as well as the good of all creatures, right? We have to take this in context of everything we know about God so far in the story already. So do we think that Genesis is all of a sudden depicting a God with this different punitive character? I don't think so. It doesn't seem like a good reading to me. And if we don't, then I think we have to assume that the expulsion was ultimately for the love and care of humans and the rest of creation, despite that it's a kind of sad and hard thing. Final thought here, I'm wondering if all of these natural consequences that are unpacked in the, you know, section called the curses, Could that merely be explicating what God meant by saying, you will surely die, in the prohibition against eating the fruit? We have disruptions of relationship with God, disruptions of relationship with each other and the earth, disruptions that made life more difficult and ultimately went hand in hand with humans being returned to the dust of the earth. I don't know, sounds a lot like death to me. Okay, now let's talk about the next aspect of sin. And sorry for the stupid rhyme in this slide. I couldn't help myself. I am a dad after all, so. Okay, so I would say that Genesis sees, you know, the fall and the sin that led to the fall as an unfortunate and certainly consequential, as we just talked about, but ultimately only incremental step in the story of humankind. It's not something totally cataclysmic that just broke and ruined everything. So, you know, we're fond of calling these events the fall with a capital F because it's, you know, we see it as so significant. And it is significant, and it's the first crisis in the Genesis story that doesn't have, you know, a happy ending. But the natural consequences of the fall we just talked about don't represent some kind of break in reality itself. The world doesn't stop being good. Humans don't stop being good. The curses that we just looked at are not actually describing a magical change in reality to make reality worse, so much as a change in human experience due to human choice to live in a mode of distrusting God and a mode of, you know, attempting to blame or dominate one another. This is obviously a bad situation. It's not what God wanted, and it limits the human's experience to a significant degree, especially in their no longer being able to eat the fruit of the tree of life we just talked about. But there's not this kind of harsh break from one reality to another. It's just a change of location, basically. I think it's also important to mention here that human work and vocation, specifically, are not fundamentally tainted by sin. I'm not going to say more about it right now because that was a big part of Nelson's sermon a few weeks ago, and he covered all that. But just again, to be clear that sin doesn't do anything to change fundamentally human vocation, what God called people to do in the world. Though it might throw small or large roadblocks in the way, make it more difficult. And finally, sin is not, I think, a foregone conclusion, even for people after the fall. There's this conversation with God and Cain that we read about. And I think the best way of translating that conversation with Cain has God saying, if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you may rule over it. That's really how the Hebrew verb should be translated. Not must, but may. And so it indicates this sense of possibility, right? Cain wasn't so tainted by sin that God was like, well, he's going to kill people. He's a sinful human being. You know, he has a conversation and says, here's what's going to happen. These are consequences. It's up to you. So I think that's ultimately a hopeful perspective for us. In all of this discussion of sin in Genesis, what I think emerges is that God cares primarily about life, goodness, wholeness, in a word, shalom. All of God's prohibitions, not eating the tree, fruit of the tree, and so on, they're for the sake of maintaining shalom. They're not about demanding arbitrary moral perfection just to see if we can live up to a standard for the sake of obedience. The sin that matters to God is not, you know, messing up an arbitrary rule, but missing the mark of shalom, which is deeply non-arbitrary, right? It's what's good. We've already talked a little bit about this, but let's dig a bit deeper into this contrast between shalom and moral performance. On a reading of Genesis, which meshes well with everything we've talked about so far, I don't think it's possible to see the tree of knowledge of good and evil as some kind of moral test. Some big no-no that God put out there just to see whether we would obey him, right? I think the tree, in the story anyway, is described of as having an important place in the garden. It was in the very middle of it, after all, which means something. It was a singular special tree bearing a singular special fruit that, like all the other fruit in the garden, I believe the humans were supposed to eat. Why the prohibition then? Well, I think it was there because the humans just weren't supposed to eat it yet. There's nothing in Genesis, actually, or the Bible that suggests that humans becoming like God is an inherently bad thing in and of itself. We are made in his image, after all, and in the story, we were already significantly like God before eating the fruit. And as Christians, of course, we see ourselves as joining in with Christ's indestructible life at the end of days, another type of life that in some ways is partakes of or is like God's life, and so on. But becoming like God by attempting to decide good and evil for ourselves, setting our own targets on our own terms and on our own timeline, is not actually good for us. Since when we get it wrong, creation and our fellow humans suffer. And so I read the prohibition as a loving warning. The same way that we tell our toddlers not to stick their fingers in electrical sockets. I'm just checking my emoji on this slide. Make sure, yes, they came across fine. So, you know, I'm pretty sure at some point that I told my little boy in good, King James English, but of the electrical socket on that wall, thou shalt not stick thy fingers into it. For in the day that thou stickest therein, thou shalt surely die. Right? Don't touch that. It'll hurt you badly. It's not that electricity is bad. It's just that it's not for toddlers, right? It's for mature adults who know how to contain and channel it appropriately, and who ideally have developed the character in imitation of a good creator in order to use it for purposes of shalom. So think about that next time you plug your phone into the charger, right? How am I using my phone for shalom? Even with Cain, right, we see God interested more in maintaining as much shalom as possible rather than insisting on, you know, moral balance. When Cain kills Abel and God expresses the natural consequences to Cain, that he'll be a wanderer on the earth, which means he won't be in community with other people anymore. Makes sense. He killed one of them, right? You destroy community when you kill people. And Cain complains that whoever finds him will kill him because he's quite aware that, you know, there's this culture of vengeance around him. But God says that no, he will actually protect Cain, the murderer, and that anyone who avenges Abel by killing Cain will actually experience even greater consequences. Can you imagine a more radically prophetic injunction against the cycle of violence kicked off by vengeance? And this is right here in the very first chapters of Genesis. Kind of blows my mind how strong and clear this is, but how easy it is to miss what God is doing. So Cain has killed Abel, and God obviously didn't want that. It's a huge rupture of shalom. But God cares much more about preventing further harm and damage to his precious children, even Cain, and his precious creation, than about keeping the moral ledger balanced. Okay, let's do a bit of a recap and summary here. Thanks for coming along with me, by the way, on this reading of Genesis 2-4, which, you know, I acknowledge might be familiar to some of you or might feel totally different from, you know, the version of the story that you grew up with. And hopefully either way, we've found some good reasons from Genesis itself to think about sin in a way that's a bit, you know, healing or hopeful. When we read Genesis closely, I think what we find is that sin is regarded as missing the mark of shalom, specifically. God wants us to uphold shalom, not as an arbitrary moral commandment or test, but because harmonious relationships between humans and God, humans and each other, humans and the rest of creation, are what's actually good for us. It's what leads to life. And like a good parent or caregiver, God tries to help us hit that mark of shalom by creating good context for us and giving us good advice, like, don't do that thing that will hurt you. But when we do miss the mark anyway, he He doesn't heap additional punishment or shame on top of the natural consequences of sinning. And as we know, these are often plenty on their own. After all, the consequences of us missing the mark of shalom are the lack of shalom, which is bad, feels bad. It's the main problem we see around us, right? Violence, domination, oppression of people and creatures that God made to be regarded with equality and loving care. So I think in all of this, Genesis is very clear that God is totally and completely good. The problem is our missing the mark of shalom. And unfortunately, even when we do strive to hit the mark of shalom in our personal or communal lives, we're not immune to the rupture of violence from others. Since, you know, the mythical days of Adam and Eve, lack of shalom, sin, has become endemic in our cultures. Well, there are these deep gouges that have been carved out in our ways of acting by repeatedly missing that mark of shalom over and over on down the centuries. And these gouges are now so deep that our individual efforts to, you know, to do right from the perspective of shalom seem like they're totally ineffective or could maybe never fill them in, which can be a little bit despairing, I think. But into this despairing situation, and already in the early chapters of Genesis, God puts a plan in motion, right? This is the start of the story. And God, in fact, puts several plans into motion, and some of them don't maybe pan out the way that he hoped. But there is a plan or plans to deal with this issue of humans repeatedly missing the mark of shalom. And how exactly that plan unfolds is the story that's told, you know, in the rest of the Bible, and is not something that we'll talk about this morning because we don't want to be here for like 12 more hours. So that's it. I just want to end by asking a question, and I want to leave it to maybe an actual pastor at Artisan to answer the question in some future sermon, because I've been thrown under the bus here, so I'm going to leave it to someone else to, you know, to bring it all together sometime in the future. If humans missing the mark of shalom is the core problem of history, as I've, you know, tried to argue, and if, as Christians believe, Jesus is somehow the answer, what exactly about Jesus' life, death, and resurrection is it that makes it possible for shalom to be restored? For shalom to be restored in ourselves, our own insides, in our families, communities, our nations, and in all creation. So again, I'll leave it to someone else to hopefully answer that question for us down the road. But if you have any thoughts on that or want to chat about it,